Our next presenter is Dr. Gavin Mudd, who's a senior lecturer in environmental engineering at Monash University. And Gavin has been an active researcher and advocate on the environmental impacts and management of mining for over a decade. His areas of expertise are mining sustainability, uranium mining, groundwater, environmental impact assessment and environmental management, and he's undertaken research from mining companies, community groups and Indigenous organisations. So
this is really serious stuff. When I first started looking at coal seam gas issues, you know, some years ago, it really stunned me, the lax culture and just the... We'll make a lot of assumptions and we'll just believe there's no impact. And to me, I think that's one of the biggest problems. And I think we've already heard some great evidence from Carmel about the sort of damage that that sort of culture does within our profession. So I'm actually really glad I started with this slide, because to me, I think one of the biggest problems we have with the coal seam gas debate is there is no debate. Actually, well, we should be having a debate about what are the future energy sources for Australia. And it's not just exporting more coal or exporting more carbon and having no responsibility for the climate change emissions associated with that as well. And in a sense, this was more written with respect to coal mining some years ago, but it's still exactly the same problem. We're not debating what is the future. And what I've always found is there's much more support for renewable energy right around Australia and things. So to me, I think this is, again, I think cartoonists have a good sense of reality. All right. So again, we'll go through this pretty quickly. Don't want to dwell on this, but basically, as we all know, coal mining, and in terms of the old canary in the coal mine, gas has always been a problem in coal mining. It's really only over the last 20 or 30 odd years that the industry started to realise that actually getting it out of the coal is not that hard. And actually, if you do it before you start coal mining, for example, you can improve the safety, and then sometimes you can even collect that gas and sell it. So why not do it on an even bigger scale in areas such as, say central Queensland, where there's certainly no plans for active coal mining at the moment, but there's still a big CSG resource. So in that sense, one of the issues that's different, you know, if you're looking at, say, a conventional coal, conventional gas field compared to, say, coal seam gas, is on the right here, we've got the amount of water that would come out over time with a conventional gas field, such as Bass Strait or Moomba or the North West Shelf. Coal seam gas is a bit different, and it's basically the different nature, the characteristics of the coal, because it tends to be captured in a lot of the cracks and fractures and is held under pressure a lot more. So the reason why you have to do so much hydraulic fracturing and cracking of the aquifers is to really release the water, and then once you've released the water, then the gas will start to flow. And again, we've seen some photos from Carmel as well, but this is some of the drilling that's been done in Queensland. And it does give you a sense of a lot of the infrastructure that's involved. And one of the things I think the industry just hasn't really got their head around is when you look at a coal mine, you go and drill some exploration bores, and the real heavy impacts start when you actually start mining. With coal seam gas, a lot of the heavy activities actually really start at the exploration stage. The amount of work that's involved in drilling, and then the testing, and the amount of pumping that has to be done to test the characteristics and work out at what gas rate you might be able to extract that. So a lot of the risks that would normally be left to the decisions around commercial operations are suddenly going beneath the radar, because our environmental assessment system doesn't account for the fact that there are heavy risks even at the exploration stage in CSG. And that's one of the things that I think the industry is still trying to catch up on. And if you look at these things, these photos might look pretty simple, but I'm sure you'll hear from Ruth a bit more later about some of the what this really means in terms of, you know, if you're a farmer or things like that. But you know, I'm a gas consumer. I also consume food as well. So in that sense, people often think that having this type of infrastructure in some farmer's backyard, it's just NIMBYism. And it's like, well, no. And I agree with Shane. This is a national issue. We are responsible. We're either getting the taxes from some of the coal seam gas, or we consume the food that actually is being displaced by some of these sorts of things. So it is a national issue. In some ways, a very international issue. Now, if we think about a lot of these sorts of things, and we've already heard some sort of excellent examples from the Pilliga, from Carmel, but there is a debate about the compatibility of land use. I'm not a great believer that you can have multiple land use on the same thing. You can't have a lot of farming, you know, on the same site where you've got a coal mine or coal seam gas. I think it's really a furphy that is being promoted by industry in that sense. We've already heard about some of the surface water impacts. The area where I suppose I've always focused is a lot of the groundwater impacts. And that's really where a lot of the big ticket items are, and it's quite stunning. Some of the examples I've seen, and one of the projects in New South Wales that is in commercial operation, And at least their annual environmental monitoring reports are available online. So, you know, give the company credit for that. But in it, they've got this little statement, two little paragraphs, and basically it goes like this. There was a technical assessment done predicting there'd be no impacts on groundwater, and therefore we don't monitor, and therefore there's no impact. Now, if I tried to publish that myself in a journal, I'd get laughed at. In fact, I wouldn't even get laughed at. It wouldn't even be considered. That lacks culture. We believe there won't be any impact, so we'll just justify that, let alone the fact they actually forgot to reference their technical assessment. So that's a bit poor form anyway. But that's the culture that's really governed a lot of this industry. We'll just make these sorts of assumptions without good technical data. Now, whether it's the insurance industry or whether it's something like nuclear power and Fukushima or all sorts of things, a culture in an industry that says no data, no problem, I think is very dangerous. And we can see that in many, many places. So for me, when you look at a lot of sustainable management, whether it's groundwater, whether it's mining, whether it's farming or all sorts of things, we should be having good data to prove there's no problem. And I think that is the basis of what should be good policy, and that's clearly been lacking. Now, I put some numbers on here because I thought it was important to at least get a sense of the growth of CSG. So this brown line here is that's the growth of how much gas is being pulled out of Queensland in terms of, say, petajoules or PJ for good tech heads. But you can also see the amount of water there. And we're not just talking about a tiny bit of water, and the industry would like to make people believe that, oh, it's just a small bit of water. Well, we're talking about gigalitres, and at the rate that that's growing, and you know, with the gas extraction and so on as well, we're talking about tens of gigalitres already. And when you start multiplying the size of the industry by 10 or more, which is what the industry is working towards, we're dealing with very, very large volumes of water. Not only large volumes of fresh water, but large volumes of water that's often salty, often has heavy metals in it, sometimes at highly variable concentrations, but also has a whole bunch of other stuff in there that we know is generally not the sort of thing you want in the environment. So these are some photos, and in some ways this is the earlier part of the industry where it wasn't just the footprint at the well, it's actually the large ponds that have to store that water. And if you're a farmer that's sort of working in this area, you can see why it actually starts to alienate a lot of land, and actually I think it is incompatible with things like trying to maintain sort of farming. This is again from the earlier parts of the industry, and it was impacts like this when you get the salty water dry out. And you only have to go to some parts not far away from here in Western New South Wales where we see what happens when salty water dries out because you get a salt lake. If people haven't been to places like Lake Eyre or many of the other salt lake systems that are quite natural, they're incredible ecosystems. But this one's not natural. This one, in terms of all the salt water that's coming out or the produced water, say, from the coal seam gas operations, we can see that the salt storm that's coming off, all that dust that's blowing out, which is why a lot of the CSG projects are now not allowed to go ahead with these sorts of things, and they have to develop things like water treatment. So these impacts are real, you know, and they've been so poorly documented, and I think the industry has certainly almost cut its leg off in some ways because they haven't been transparent with the data, they haven't been monitoring very well, and so a lot of these really key questions from a scientific point of view, we really don't have good answers for yet. And if I was a farmer in that sort of position, I just assume the impacts will be at the worst end of the scale, which is, from a human point of view, that's quite reasonable. Again, these graphs are quite noisy, so I just want to try and point out a couple of things very quickly. And again, this is actually from Ruth's part of the world, up near Dalby. You can see the water level. See these sort of little blue triangles on the top graph, and you see the water level going up and down. And that's natural variation, either pumping groundwater, or you get some big recharge events from maybe some floods that go through. And then you can see the water level start to come down. We can see when coal seam gas started, and then all of a sudden the groundwater levels just started dropping dramatically. And that's not unexpected. If you start pumping a lot of water underground and change the pressure regimes, you would expect some change. But if you look at the one on the bottom, you can see a lot of these bores. We can see the little purple lines here. That's when coal seam gas started, or at least near that bore. And yet we're not seeing any change. But there's still a long-term decline, which is very gradual over time. Whether that's drought or climate change or over-extraction or a mix of all of the above, and some people say, oh, well, therefore that means there's no impact. It's actually, well, no, it just means that we haven't seen the impacts yet. The nature of the groundwater systems that we're dealing with in coal seam gas are very slow moving. They will take probably decades to reach that sort of new equilibrium and that new position. And that's the sort of thing that I think is still very poorly understood yet. All right. One of the things that, you know, that is my bias, you know, having taught groundwater at Monash many years and being involved with it, but it's a complex resource. We've got to take one point in space, some points in time, hopefully, when you've got a bunch of groundwater samples, and then extrapolate over really large areas and over long periods of time. And we know from, you know, impacts like dry land salinity, from the drawdown we've seen in the Great Artesian Basin. Another thing, sometimes we're talking about processes that take a century or more to reach their final equilibrium, to reach their final endpoint. Coal seam gas will be no different. And so taking 1 year of data and then extrapolating over 100 years is, no, that's not good science. So a lot of these issues that people are worried about, and there is evidence for these things, right? So whether it's the altered flow regimes, the impact on water quality, sort of the famous lighting of the tap water in America, all of these things are very real. Slowly science is starting to catch up. We can see that in America they've started to show that if you're near a shale gas operation, you're generally going to have a much higher chance of having high methane concentrations, and often higher than was there prior to mining. So this is just a cross-section. Just to point out that we always hear that, oh, but our operations here are different, they're very deep. Well, so is the Marcellus Shale in America. It's at 2 kilometres. And yet you can see where people have got groundwater bores up here, they're seeing impacts. We can see if you put your distance to the nearest gas bore and then the methane concentration in groundwater, the closer you are to a gas bore, there's a good chance that sometimes you're actually going to have higher methane concentrations, and based on the testing that's been done, the fingerprinting that's been done for that paper, it's clearly coming from the Marcellus Shale. How it's getting there is sort of the big question at the moment. But you know, so in that sort of sense, from a groundwater point of view, when you look at these things, there's still a lot we don't know. And I think in a lot of ways, because the monitoring has been so poor, the culture has always been no data, no problem. And I think in a lot of ways, that's not good enough. You know, it's not the sort of thing that, it's not the sort of approach to good science and good policy, I think. So in that sense, I'm a great believer in the fact that we need much better monitoring, much better transparency, and we really should be slowing down before we go too far ahead and realise, like we've done with the GAB, like we've done with dry land salinity, like we've done with climate change, that a century later we've realised we've made some pretty bad mistakes. So I think in that sense, sure, it works. Some companies can make money out of it, things like that, but some of these major impacts, I think, are still unresolved. One of the important things to distinguish is you don't need to add benzene to get benzene in the groundwater. Benzene's naturally found in the coal. So in that sense, and this is one of the big distinctions that really often gets mixed up in the media, it may not be added into the chemicals that are used in terms of the hydraulic fracturing, but because it's associated with the water that's being extracted out of the coal, you will find benzene that's derived from the coal, not from the chemicals added. And a lot of the media reporting I've seen often mixes that up. But certainly benzene, it's a known carcinogen, something that causes cancer. It's not something we want to be putting into water or getting down creek lines or things like that. Things that are used are things like sometimes polymers, and it all depends on the chemistry of the coal. It depends on and people say, well, it's coal, but there's a lot of different properties of coal sometimes. So there's a whole range of different chemicals you can add, depending on the chemistry of the water as well. Some waters are slightly acidic, some are more alkaline, and depending on the makeup of the salts in the water as well, you can add a whole range of different chemicals. So, and some of those might be quite common, but a lot of them aren't and stuff. So I can't remember all of them off the top of my head. But typically they're added because the sorts of properties you want to be able to either expand when you get this as you're under pressure, so you're injecting, and you want to be able to maintain that. So you add certain chemicals to basically, maximise the sort of the fracture size and under the pressure and things like that. So typically when you inject chemicals, depending on who you believe, it can be anywhere from 20% to 80% is unrecovered. So if you're injecting so many chemicals, depending on which number you want to believe and who you believe, it will depend on what proportion, but you rarely ever recover 100% of the chemicals you inject. And then in the process, when you extract that water back, say in commercial operations or even in pilot operations or whatever, you can then extract some of the chemicals out of the coal like benzene and others.